I want to continue with what I've been teaching the last two times I've been here from the Wao Ju Jing. It's a Taoist book purported to be the unknown teachings of Lao Tzu, who is the name most associated with Taoism. And many people know the Tao Te Ching. It's a major text. So this is translated by Brian Walker, who I believe is not necessarily a Chinese scholar, but he is a poet and obviously works with Taoist texts. So anyhow, if you're interested in the previous two talks, I did four verses. Please access them on our line. So now I want to focus on a couple of others. So this is verse 52. Do you think you can clear your mind by sitting constantly in silent meditation? This makes your mind narrow, not clear. Integral awareness is fluid and adaptable, present in all places and all times. That is true meditation. So that's the first verse. It goes on. So I think it's very relevant to us. Do we practice sitting meditation? Yes. Do we think that sitting meditation is an essential part of learning how to develop mindfulness and concentration and insight? Yes. So this is not saying don't meditate in a formal way. All right. But he's saying, and I think it's obvious to all of us, that we do not spend our lives informal meditation, do we? Especially as lay people, we live in a very active world. So if our capacity to have an aware mind, a present mind, an empty mind, non-judgmental mind, all the things, a relaxed mind, all the things that we cultivate, a concentrated mind, only on the cushion, it's not very beneficial as it could be. Right? So when he says that makes our minds narrow, not clear, it like gives it a narrow focus because we think we need these ideal conditions. Everybody ever notice that? Especially when you're starting meditation, or somebody talking in the next room, or there's some noise. We think, oh, it's a distraction. They'd only shut up, or why are they playing that music, or. So there's a world of endless distractions that are taking me away from my meditation. So can you see that's kind of narrow and not very applicable? It's sort of like, when they do scientific research, they often do it in a laboratory under ideal conditions. But if it can't be replicated in the real world, then it's not very predictable in its capacity of accomplishing what it wants to accomplish. So in our sitting meditation, in our formal meditation, this is like our laboratory, right? Where we do our best to kind of create ideal conditions. But if this is the only place that we can clarify and relax and have an open mind, then it is very narrow. Okay, so this is very important that we all understand that. And this is really sort of the essence of Zen and other things. Integral awareness is fluid and adaptable, present in all places and all times. That is true meditation. Right? Right. So, right now, you're all aware, aren't you? Is that true? Just nod your head if that's true. We're all aware, aren't we? You're all aware, you're, through your eyes, you're aware of what you're seeing. Through your ears, you're aware of what you're hearing. You may be aware of thoughts or feelings. You may be aware of your body. You may be aware of tastes in your mouth. You may be aware of how your body's feeling, good or bad. You know, you could be aware, you know, a little pain here or something. We're aware, aren't we? Is that clear? The most omnipresent experience we're having right now is that we're aware. And when we walk out the door, you know what? Unless you're dead, you will be what? Aware. And when you get in your car and you drive, you will be what? And when you go home, what do you will be? And when you turn on your computer or you look at your thing, what are you going to be? Aware. When you go to work, how do you know you're at work? Anybody can figure that one out. How do you know you're at work? Because you're aware. So awareness is the fundamental aspect of our minds. Our problem is what? We identify with the objects that we're aware of. And we do not maintain the awareness that the fundamental thing that's always happening from the moment we get up in the morning to the time we fall asleep at night is we're just aware of all these various things that are appearing. Appearing in the external world, appearing in the internal world, good things, bad things, wanted things, unwanted things, right? That's our daily life. But all of that is appearing only because we're aware. And awareness, he says, is fluid and adaptable. So when I stop talking, pay very close attention, and now I started talking, and now I stopped talking, did your awareness have any problem dealing with that? No. Your awareness is totally adaptable. Your eyes, your seeing, wherever you go, wherever you do, it just sees. The ears just hear, the nose just smells, the tongue just tastes, the body just senses. Thoughts arise and disappear, and we're aware. So the awareness is totally adaptable and fluid. It's just like a river of awareness that just keeps flowing. We can even be aware of our dreams, even when our five senses are quiet, right? We're asleep. So we're not seeing, we're not hearing, we're not smelling, we're not tasting, we're not sensing, and yet we're aware. Because oftentimes in our dreams, we're aware that we're dreaming. So this awareness, which is fluid and adaptable, is always present. And so he's saying, to clear your mind by being able to know that you're aware and not grasping at the things that you're aware of is the true meditation. Now, when we're meditating like we meditate this morning, where we meditate with an object like our body or our breath, right? We are using an object to focus our awareness. So we're learning a skill. And when a thought arises in our mind, or we hear a sound, our mind, because of its habit energy, what does it do? Is it just aware, or does it do something else? What does it do? It happens to all of us. It grasps. It hears a sound, it says, oh, that's traffic. Oh, that's that. That's a car backfiring. That's somebody playing music. Or that's, you see, we don't just hear. We're not just aware, we grasp. And then we often then it just makes a bigger story and a bigger story. Right. So in the meditation, what are we learning? That when the mind grasps at something or grabs hold of something, we learn to what? Let go. And come back to just being aware. So we're training our minds in staying aware. But in this case, we're using a focus. When we go out into the world, we can use our awareness of our body breath to kind of ground us. But if, you know, we're totally absorbed in our body and breath, we will sort of miss life. So the key thing is when we enter life is just to maintain this flow of awareness. Right? Things happen, things don't. I mean, things appear, things disappear. Thoughts arise, you know, everything just arising and disappearing all the time. Every experience we have just arising. Can we enter the flow? That's our challenge. Now the next verse. Who can attain clarity and simplicity by avoiding the world? The Tao, which is the way, the Dharma, the way of how to live in truth, is clear and simple, and it doesn't avoid the world. So we don't have to avoid the world, we don't have to avoid work, we don't have to avoid relationships. The truth of this is nothing's getting in our way, which is hard for us to believe, isn't it? Because we think all kinds of things are getting in the way of me practicing, right? People say that all the time. I mean, especially like a holiday. Well, I was away visiting my family, so I really couldn't practice. You hear that a lot. Or, you know, I got a lot going on at work, and so I can't practice. Or this is happening, so I can't practice. I've been traveling a lot, so I can't practice. But that's if you define your practice in this narrow way of like a formal meditation. Is that clear? But if your practice is, I'm just aware and present to whatever it is, not grasping, not pushing away, totally open, then there's nothing in the world that could happen that could prevent you from practicing. Because they say the true meditation is this integral awareness that is fluid and adaptable and present in all places and times. There has never been a moment in our life when we've not been aware. But our problem is what? We've gotten lost in the drama of what we're aware of, gotten caught up in it, and repeat and repeat and repeat, attach. Push away, and get caught up in a lot of emotionality. Is that clear? And when that happens, what happens to the flow of our awareness? What? Yeah, just it's like a dam, right? What, you know, they dam up a river, and then the flow of the river is interrupted. It's held back. But the natural energy of the river is what? It wants to flow. It wants to flow. It wants to, you know, the little mountain stream wants to flow down and join with other streams and become a creek, and the creeks want to all keep flowing, and they all get together, and they become a little river, and then they get a bigger river, and eventually they go what? They go to the sea. They go to the ocean. That's the natural flow. Our mind awareness has a natural flow. It just wants to keep flowing. There's only one thing that gets in the way of the natural flow of our awareness. It's we misuse our minds. We don't really understand deeply the way they really are, how they really work. So this is reminding us. The true meditation is to become, is to allow this integral awareness, fluid and adaptable, present in all places and times. This is our true meditation. It does not need to avoid the world. It embraces the world. But it embraces the world with awareness and presence, openness. The Tao is simple and doesn't avoid the world. And then, and again, this is kind of a list, but it's pointing us in a direction. So we have this natural awareness that's always present and aware, but then we encounter the world, right? So when we encounter the world, do we just go through it like a, I don't know, just like a robot of awareness? Awareness. No, we encounter the world. We're alive. We have relationships. We work. We respond. Is that clear? So we're not awareness robots. Don't bother me. I'm just being aware. So then he says, when he says, okay, so who can attain clarity and simplicity by avoiding the world? The Tao or the way is clear and simple. It doesn't avoid the world. And then he says, why not simply honor your parents, love your children, help your brothers and sisters, be faithful to your friends, care for your mate with devotion, complete your work cooperatively and joyfully, assume responsibility for problems, practice virtue without first demanding it of others, understand the highest truths, yet retain an ordinary manner? I mean, how's it sound? Right? So we have this natural awareness that allows us to be present to everything, but in the actual experience of living, right? Living, relating, that's where we get screwed up, don't we? So as you probably, and I'm going to go through this, as you heard the list, you go, can't check off that one. Can't check off that one either. Now, why is that? Because we encounter the world with all kinds of thoughts and projections. We encounter the world with what? Our stuff. Our historical stuff. Right? All the stuff that's in us that just prevents us from naturally responding to life. Naturally letting our hearts be open and free. We've gotten sort of twisted up inside. So we don't flow in this very natural way. But when we hear it, we go, well, of course. Yeah, honor my parents. Why should I honor my parents? I wouldn't be here without them. They gave me life. I mean, that's the bottom line. Whether they were good parents or bad parents, the parents I wanted, the parents I didn't want, you know. The bottom line is I wouldn't be here. I mean, they gave me life. So they're to be honored for that, if not other things. Love your children. I have nothing to say about that. Help your brothers and sisters. Who are your brothers and sisters? We're all brothers and sisters. We're all in the human family. I mean, would we each like if other people always were there for us? I mean, is there anybody who says, no, I don't. No, we would love it, right? If other people were always there for us, supportive of us, kind to us, helped us out when we needed it. We'd love it. It's like, what a wonderful world. What a good friend. Help your brothers and sisters. Be faithful to your friends. Care for your mate with devotion. Complete your work cooperatively and joyfully. How many of us just close your eyes and say, oh, yeah, that's the way I work. I'm always very cooperative, working well with other people, wanting to be in harmony with other people, and I take joy in what I'm doing. Close your eyes a second. Is that the way you go to work every day? Is that the way you are at work? And if the answer is no, who's the loser? You see what I'm saying? Well, if you stop, who's the loser? I mean, if you stop and you ask yourself rationally, okay, I spend, you know, a significant part of my life at work. For many people, most of their waking time, their good waking time is at work. And if I ask myself, how do I want to be at work? Would I like to be in harmony with my with the people I work with? Would I like to be, you know, enjoy what I'm doing? I mean, is anybody, you don't have to raise your hand, when anybody say, no, I really want to go to work and, yeah, not like, I really don't like, I don't want to like the people I'm with, and I always want to be in conflict with everybody. I think that's called an antisocial personality. Yeah, we don't want to be that way. And yet, you know, and like all these other things, you know, honor your parents, love your children, help your brothers and sisters, be faithful for your friends, care for your mate with devotion, complete your work cooperatively and joyfully. We hear the list and we go, yes, yeah, of course. And yet if we ask ourselves, is that the way I show up in these areas of life? We may not be able to answer yes. And of course we would have, you know, we're not going to get into it, but we'd have to ask ourselves, you know, well, what gets in the way? What holds me back, or what contaminates, or what skews things? That I can't show up because the Tao just flows in harmony with everything. Why am I not in harmony with my life, with the people I live with? Yeah. Assume responsibility for problems. Close your eyes a second. Ask yourself, am I one of those who, in the face of problems, am I somebody who blames others, holds others responsible for the problems around me and problems that I have in my own life? Do I take responsibility for the problems in my life? You know, in sort of modern parlance, we talk about, you know, empowerment versus victimization. It's kind of a newer way of looking at the same issue. To be empowered is to take responsibility for our life and everything that's going on within it and around it. When we take that responsibility, then we know that we have an ability to interact and to make a difference. But if I see myself as somebody who's just a victim of life, victim of my past, victim of my childhood, victim of other people, victim of situations, and always blame others, why is the world a mess? Because we're a mess, right? And if you don't think you're a mess, then maybe look around your family and, well, they're a mess. I mean, you know, the world's a mess because we're a mess. So we need to start assuming responsibility for the mess as our own. Assume responsibility for problems. This is a good one. Practice virtue without first demanding it of others. Sort of reminds me when I used to, was a therapist and I used to do couples counseling. And you'd always find these couples which would go, well, he's got to change first. You know, he's got to say I'm sorry first, before then I will. Anybody know that one? You know, it's like keeping score, right? You know, I'll be kind, but first you be kind to me. Practice virtue without first demanding it of others. That's very wonderful. Again, it's taking responsibility. Yeah, I want to show up in the world in a virtuous way. I want to be kind. I want to be loving. I want to speak nobly to other human beings, right? That's what I want to do. You know, the rest of the world may not be working from the same agenda, right? That's okay. It's okay. I don't need to wait on the world. You know, it's like Thich Nhat Hanh or other people say, you know, peace begins with me. Peace begins with me. I want a peaceful world. Can I become a peaceful person? That's taking responsibility. I want a world where people take care of one another and love each other more and, you know, more compassionate. Okay. Begins with me. Can I be that person? Practice virtue without demanding of others. You know, there's an... I'm always late to the popular culture game, but everybody know what virtue signaling is? Anybody not know what virtue signaling is? Oh, good. I'm not that out of touch. I forget where it is. Somebody, I think, told me about it. But virtue signaling is when you do something virtuous or you do something that you think is virtuous, you always have to let other people know it. You signal it. Okay? I just want to let you know, I just donated such and such to such and such. I just wanted to let you know, I just was down the soup kitchen. See what a virtuous person I am. Actually, in Zen, there's a tradition called hidden virtue. I learned about that many, many years ago. Hidden virtue. Hidden virtue being the most virtuous way to be, which is, you know, it's like you just do a virtuous act, but you don't let anybody know you're doing it. You don't want to be acknowledged. You don't want any results. You don't want any thank yous. It's like it may not be your turn to clean the dishes, but you just do it. And you don't tell anybody that you did it. Right. You see somebody else's shoes are not straightened, and you just straighten them out. You see something's a little dirty, and you just clean it up. You see somebody needs something, and you just give it to them. You don't need to signal to anybody that I'm a virtuous person, because that again gets into the world of self and ego, and we know that ego is very sneaky, right? It'll take credit for anything. Some people it'll take credit for what a bad person I am. I'm such a bad person, right? as an identity. And also take credit for being a good person. See how virtuous I am. Look at me. On Sunday morning, everybody else is running around or sleeping in or God knows what they're doing. I'm practicing meditation. I'm really something. It's like that. Practice virtue without first demanding of others and then understand the highest truth, yet retain an ordinary manner. Again, which is very Zen. This is why I sort of like it. Zen and Taoism have a lot in common. In Zen, we say, I already have one head, I don't need another head. What's that other head? I don't need a Zen head. You see? I don't need a spiritual head. I don't need to take on a persona of anything. I can be totally natural. I can just be me. I don't have to. Is everybody clear? I mean, that's so important that we not turn our spiritual life or our religious life or whatever it is in a way that it becomes a new identity. Actually, in Buddhism, we're trying to get rid of all our identities and be just totally natural and genuine as a human being. So all the practices we do and all the things we learn, we're just doing it so we can become who we are, who we truly are at our best, you see. So we don't need, so that's what it means, you know, when they say in Zen, I don't need an identity to be I'm a Zen practitioner. That's like putting another head. I already have one head. I don't need a second Zen head. Understand the highest truths. Yeah, so that's inward. I'm practicing all the Dharma, all the way that I am, so I can become, I can heal and transform my own body-mind, so I can show up in the world in a way that I can contribute to the happiness and the harmony of others and the world, right? That's all we're doing here. So even though the manifestation of our practice hopefully has a positive effect on others in the world, and yet the reason we're doing it, because we know, for me, this is the nobler way to live. And then the last line is, to understand, so after that whole list, so he says, that would be true clarity, true simplicity, true mastery. So again, it's wonderful to have a meditation practice, it's wonderful to study, it's wonderful to understand life more deeply. But why do all that? So we can show up in the world in a different way. All these things, all these practices we do, the retreats we go on, the things we learn, I mean, all that, it's to facilitate our own, again, healing and transformation. But again, we're not isolated. We don't live alone. We live in relationship to others, family, friends, colleagues, neighbors, the world, community, city, town. You know, this is how we show up. And so our practice should help us show up in this way. Yeah, so let's just stop for a few minutes. Any questions in the hall? Any questions about what this is about or how you live this? Because it's all about how to live it. Online, people can raise their virtual hand and Didi will acknowledge them. But are you raising your real hand? Yes, Didi.
Maya would like it if you could repeat the name of the book that you're referencing and the author.
So it's the Hua Hua Wu Jing, Huachuching, The Unknown Teachings of Lao Tzu by Brian Walker. Yes, Rob in the hall. So again, anybody online, just raise their hand by that little button in the hall. Yes, Rob, any questions?
Well, if it's okay, it's more of a comment. Just, mm-hmm. Just to make a point, a little bit of devil's advocate about the virtue signaling thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly true that there's a lot of egoism in donating money and mm-hmm. whatnot. You know, people want their name on mm-hmm. the hospital or whatever mm-hmm. and get bent out of shape if they don't get acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's manifest in Christianity too. Or Jesus said something like, well, if you show off that mm-hmm. you did this for God to the community, mm-hmm. you already got your reward, so God's not going to reward okay. you or whatever. But interestingly, there's a movement right now, and I can't remember the name, something altruism or whatever, but there are people who are generally have a lot of money and they're starting to donate it and live a specific lifestyle where they particularly try to make a lot of money.
Yeah, no, I know.
And then donate
about.
Most of it, basically live very simply.
Okay.
And there's sociological evidence that's actually counterintuitively mm-hmm. not helpful. If you have, say, a group of billionaires and one of them is giving away most mm-hmm. of their money but mm-hmm. not telling mm-hmm. anybody, they all tend to be more greedy, whereas if they suddenly announce it, there's a social contagion, and then they all are more likely to start giving away money and being more humanitarian. So that's all.
Wonderful. I'm all for billionaires giving away money and helping people. Other questions? Anybody online? Yes, ma'am. Over here.
I can speak to Bob.
No, just it's so people online can hear. So we need the.
Hello.
My question is about this balance between practicing. You start from yourself, obviously. We do it, we mm-hmm. have to build up certain muscle before we step outside and do something mm-hmm. in the world. I found for myself the comfort of sitting and peaceful feeling that I acquire when I sit. I cannot carry it outside. Every time I go out and I have the intention of being that mindful, aware human being, but what I see is among my friends and people I watch is just, it's very depressing to me. I see their attempt to be happy. They're busy with trying to be happy and they feel miserable. And it makes me want to just go back to my peaceful and quiet because I feel hopeless, or I get dragged into the drama of samsara. Yeah. So how, when it is safe to step out, and how do we do it? How do we really, in practice, do it?
Oh yeah, very good. So, what's your name?
Jayla.
You're not alone. Does everybody know what she's talking about? All right, so that's a very common, you know, especially in our world, right? So, in your meditation, you're doing two things. You're learning to develop a calm, stable, peaceful place, but you're also learning while you're doing that, thoughts come up, feelings come up, memories come up, right? And we're learning to do what? To not attach, to not, and just to let them arise and disappear. We don't grab at them, we don't push them away. So we're developing a mind that's very aware, right? But makes no judgment about what's arising. It's kind of lets things arise and disappear. Is that right? Okay. Then we step out into the so-called world. It's the same. Things are appearing in your awareness. You see people. Is that true? They tell you their stories. You see them doing this, you see them doing that. Is that true? Can you control them? No. Can you control your thoughts as you sit in meditation and you know what your next thought's going to be? No. So in meditation, one of the things we learn over time is, I have no control what's going to arise next in my mind. Right? The only thing I have control is how I respond to what arises. That's my freedom. We go out into the world, we see all kinds of things, good things, not so good things, wanted things, unwanted things, right? Happy people, unhappy people. Is that true? Can we control that? No, that's the way it is. Just the same way, it's no different than what's in my own mind. So, you learn to be present to it, and if there's something you can do to be of help, you do it. If there's nothing you can do to be of help, you understand there's nothing I can do. And you're okay with that. It's called letting go. You've heard that before?
Yeah, of course we have.
Yeah, a couple of times. It means letting go. And that's the challenge. How do we enter the world? And I don't mean, you know, the world with all its wars and I mean, that's another whole issue. But just the world like you're talking about, the world of friends and family and all their stuff, and right, and their fears and their lonelinesses and their addictions and their angers and their stuff. Right. How do we, you know, just like this. But that takes practice. Because I think if you watch your mind as you go through your day, right, very carefully, the same way you do in meditation, you will see very clearly what disturbs it. You see, the same way, you know, you might be meditating, and all of a sudden you realize, I'm not meditating, I'm ruminating. Anybody ever notice that? Hold on, did I miss an instruction here? Right? You see, like no one's giving you the instruction to ruminate about anything. Right, we're here to not ruminate, but yet we often find what? Our mind is ruminating. And when we become aware, you know, hopefully, you know, not 3 days later, but at that time, you would just notice, oh, I'm ruminating, I'm just going over something. I've grasped at something, I'm holding on to something. And it's causing my mind to what? To be at ease? No, it's causing my mind to be disturbed. At that moment, when my mind's disturbed, I'm no help to myself or I'm no help to anybody else. So that's why we want to have a clear, open mind, which we cultivate on the cushion. But like you said, you know, it's like what I said earlier about ideal conditions in the laboratory, but then you go, you know, it's got to be able to be replicated in real life if it's going to be effective. So we have to take our practice out into the world, and we encounter exactly what you said. No, you don't go ouch. You go, oh, this is the world. This is the way the world is. You know, why do we go ouch? Because we don't want the world to be the way it is. But it is the way the world is. I mean, Buddhism is not a dogma. Buddhism is not a theology. The Buddha, you know, Buddhism, you know, it just came out of living experience and observation of life. Right? It's not a divine revelation. It didn't come from on high. You know, the Buddha looked deeply into his own mind, and he observed deeply the life of those around him, and that's where the Buddha's Dharma came from. I assure you, at the Buddha's time, there was a lot of ouch that he saw. You know, if you read the a lot of the suttas, and you see all people came to him with all kinds of problems, you know, including war, but also very personal stuff. And he did his best to be of help. But I don't think he ruminated about that at night. I don't think it kept him up. I would hope he was able to sleep well. Why? Because he understood this is the way of the world. This is not heaven. Is that true? This is not heaven, right? Nor is it hell. It's a mix, right? There are heavenly things about this life, there are hellish things about this life. We could go on about that. And that's the way it is. You know, I often use the analogy of nature, right? In nature, we accept, right? You know, we were at the beach the other day, and there's an osprey. Oh, look at that beautiful osprey flying around. How beautiful, right? And all of a sudden, whoosh, down in the water comes up with a big fish right in its mouth. Do I hate the osprey? Do I say he shouldn't be doing that or she shouldn't be doing that? No. I mean, human beings, so I'm just using that example that we accept that. Human beings have one thing going for them that ospreys don't have, is that we have this mind of ours. We have this wonderful mind that we can understand and we can reflect and we can, you know, think, oh, this is not, you know, killing other living beings, you know, there might be another way. You see, the ospreys can't figure that out. They just do what they do. But the wonderful thing about human beings is sort of we can overcome our more primitive nature, we might say. I mean, that's, I think, always been the function of religious teachers and spiritual teachers to go, you know, there's another way. You know, we can learn to care for one another. We can learn to take care of one another. We can live a life where we don't do harm to one another. I mean, that's fairly radical. I mean, and that's really all, you know, all the spiritual religious teachers, I mean, that's what they've sort of been up to. You know, if you kind of pull out the theology and all the, you know, all the dogma, you know, they're basically hopefully trying to help people learn that there's a better way to live. Right? Is that helpful, what I just said? Yeah, so it's we have to realize, yeah, that we all have this resistance to reality. We don't want reality to be what it is, and yet that's the way it is. That's the way these people are, that's the way their lives have unfolded, that's what's going on. You know, that's just the way it is. And the only question is there something I can do to help? Or not? If you're a world leader, or a great religious leader, you have more power to affect on a bigger scale. Most of us, you know, we act out our lives in a much smaller universe. But it doesn't mean in whatever our smaller universe is, we can't have an effect. So we all have to just kind of, you know, accept who we are, too. Let me go on, because it sort of ties into this one. This is 77. Humanity grows more and more intelligent. I mean, right? Now there's artificial intelligence. We don't even have to be intelligent anymore. You know, we can let robots or whatever they can be, you know, I mean, we don't even have to be intelligent. They can be even, all right. So humanity grows more and more intelligent, yet there is clearly more trouble and less happiness daily. He's making a point. He asked a question. How can this be so? It is because intelligence is not the same thing as wisdom. It's very powerful. Wasn't there a book or a movie like The Smartest People in the Room or something? What am I thinking of something? No, but I mean, it was like some, was it Enron? Is that what it was? Right, Enron, you know, which was that, it was basically a Ponzi scheme or something. I mean, it was a big corporation, but.
Massive accounting scheme.
And all run by very intelligent people, very smart people. These were the smartest people in the world, but they were crooks, right? So, and in our world, it's a very strange world because we put all our intelligence into what? See, when we look at these great masters, the Buddhas, and all these masters for thousands of years, they were, if you read their work, they were highly intelligent people. But they put their intelligence toward solving the problem of human happiness and human suffering. Right? I mean, what a wonderful way to use human intelligence. But In our modern culture, we use our intelligence for what? What?
To get more.
And create more and more things, more and more inventions, more and more, you know. And yet, if we ask ourselves the question, has this made life better for people in a true way? Are people happier? Are they more content? Are they more able to love? So intelligence is not the same as wisdom. This is very important. Wisdom in Buddhism means insight, understanding about how things really are. Intelligence that's not connected to any kind of wisdom without connected to any kind of ethics can run loose in the world and wreak havoc. I mean, look at our capacity for killing each other. We have used our intelligence from the days of bows and arrows and clubs, or, you know. We've used our intelligence, and it's still ongoing, to create more and more sophisticated ways of what? Of killing each other. Of destroying each other. I mean, it's... And if you think about the massive amount of human intelligence that has gone into and continues to go into developing more and more intelligent ways, sophisticated ways of killing each other, you go, is that a misplacement of intelligence? You see what I'm saying? so much intelligence in our world goes into making money. Right? I mean, people make money, you know, millions and billions, trillions. Right? You know, so much intelligence goes into making money and not really, you know, I don't know. Anyhow, when a society misuses partial intelligence and ignores holistic wisdom, its people forget the benefits of a plain and natural life. The benefits of a plain and natural life. Seduced by their desires, emotions, egos, they become slaves to bodily demands, to luxuries, to power, to unbalanced religion, to psychological excuses, then the reign of calamity and confusion begins. Again, I think the translator here is kind of a little using a little bit of free translation than probably was done in the original text, but that's okay. I think he's trying to make a point. So, intelligence without grounded in wisdom. Intelligence that only serves us to accumulate more and more and more and more creates calamity in our personal lives, because if we're putting so much energy into accumulating, we have less energy to put into the things that are really meaningful. Such as what? What's really meaningful in this life? What? Family.
Love.
Friendship. What?
Salvation.
What?
Helping others.
Anything else comes to mind? That's nature.
Joy.
I mean, it's when we stop and we go, yeah, what's, you know, what's really important? That's what he means, you know, we've lost touch with this plain and natural life, which is all here because we, and as soon as somebody asks us the question, this is what we say, right? And yet, if we stop and we look at our life, we put so much time and energy into other things. Now I understand that that is, you know, the nature of our modern life, isn't it? And it seems to be what everybody is doing. And yet, it behooves us to stop and ask ourselves, each as individuals, you know, these are the fundamental questions. Is the way I'm living my life creating happiness and well-being for me and the people I love and care about? How do I use my time and energy in this life? Yeah. Thus the reign of calamity and confusion begins. And, you know, there certainly seems to be a widespread feeling in our culture, whether they're on the right or the left or whatever way we divide ourselves up, that somehow this life is spinning in ways that are not moving in a healthy direction. Right? We don't see that happening. If anything, the opposite seems to be happening. And again, I think right here he's put his finger on it. You know, we've lost connection with ourselves, we've lost connection with the simple natural life, we've lost connection to this kind of, to this wisdom that we're really heirs to. So like, I can only talk about the Buddhist tradition, but when I see the Buddhist tradition, I see 2,600 years of human beings, very intelligent, experimenting with how to create human happiness and how to uproot human suffering. And these are very intelligent people who've used their minds to do that. So then he says, nevertheless, superior people can awaken during times of turmoil to lead others out of that mire. Just close your eyes. Do I want to be one of those? So this is not superior people like an elite, okay? Superior people are just simply people who see there's a noble way to live in this life. Nevertheless, superior people can awaken during times of turmoil to lead others out of this mire. So please ask ourselves, do I want to be one of those superior people in this time of so much turmoil and strife, so much confusion? Do I want to be one of those people to lead, help lead sentient beings out of this mire? And then he asked the question, which is obvious, but how can one liberate the many? We look around at, I forget, somebody was telling me the other day that when his father was born or something, I could be getting the numbers wrong, there were like 2 billion people in the world, and now there are 8 billion people, I mean, just in a generation or two. Like, whew, 8 billion people. That's a lot of people to liberate, isn't it? 2 billion was a lot. So how can we liberate the many? By first liberating one's own being. So this is, you know, depending on your aspiration, depending on how great a light you want to be in life. Wherever you are, wherever you're starting from, the first thing I need to do is to see the possibility of that healing and transformation within myself. Because then I'll truly know that it is possible for a human being who has lots of stuff to heal and transform. So I'll know that not just as a theoretical aspiration, but I'll know that as a reality. You know, it's like also, you know, we can see it in others, you know, we can see great exemplars, great teachers, great masters who really seem to us who are just living, you know, from a very different place than most people in their, you know, just in their presence and their realm of activity. And that can give us some trust that it is possible. We'll see other human beings like that. But even better if we've done it ourselves. Because then we know it's possible because we know ourselves and we know where we're coming from. We go, wow, if I can do it, certainly other people can do it. So not only does it build the confidence in the process, but it also gives us firsthand knowledge, you see. It's like when you've learned a skill by doing, you know, you become good at any kind of craft or skill because you've been doing it. From that doing, you know that you have capacity. And once you have that capacity, you know that not only do you have that capacity, but you could maybe help others develop that capacity because you know how to do it. This is the same, except it's just a little different because it's getting into the subjectivity or the experience of ourselves as just a human being with all our thoughts and our feelings and our past, you know what I mean? It seems a little messier, but it's the same, really. You know, I mean, the technology of Buddhism is a technology of taking an ordinary sentient being, a human being, with all their stuff and all their issues and all their delusions and and turning them into Buddhas, awakened people. That's what Buddhism is about. That was the promise of the Buddha. He said, everybody. He didn't go, when he had his great enlightenment that came from just understanding the nature of his mind, he said, this is the nature of everybody's mind. It's not just the nature of my mind. It's the nature of everybody's mind. And everybody, by setting out this path that I've set out, can come to the realization of it. Oh. See, he had the confidence to teach for 40 or 50 years in India and teach all kinds of people because he had done it himself, you see. So he knew how to help people. And so he says, how can we liberate the many? By first liberating one's own being. And one does not do this by elevating oneself, but by lowering oneself. Very interesting. One lowers themselves to that which is simple, modest, true, and integrating that into oneself, one becomes a master of simplicity, modesty, and truth. Completely emancipated from one's former false life, one discovers one's original pure nature, which is the pure nature of the universe. And then freely and spontaneously releasing one's, this is not Buddhist term, one's divine energy, one's enlightened energy, freely and spontaneously releasing it, one constantly transcends complicated situations and draws everything around one back into integral oneness. Very powerful, right? And I think if anybody has ever had the ability to be in the presence of deeply realized human beings, you see that you know, just their presence, but always how they deal with things and their capacity to always bring this higher kind of wisdom, intelligence, unconditional love into all situations just naturally radiates. Now, why does it naturally radiate? Because they touch the source, you see. And we all have that source. That's not personality. That's not ego. That's not self. So we all have that source. And so the practice of meditation and all these other practices we do are to purify, sort of like purify the vessel, so this enlightened energy can spontaneously radiate out. But first we have to do the work of what? Got to clean our house, right? Right? If you had company for Thanksgiving, you had to clean up, didn't you? Got to clean up the house first. Yeah. But this is a different kind of cleaning. It's not the kind of cleaning where you just get all the rooms cleaned, but you throw everything else in the closet and, you know. No, like, we got to get the whole thing, the whole thing straightened out, the whole thing cleaned up, right? We got to really clean up our act. And then we'll have a nice home that we can invite people into. Any questions about this? Yes.
Martin asks, how do we let go and let things be as they are when someone you love, such as your child, is living a destructive life?
Yeah, so these are the challenges, right? Some, it's like letting go, right? Some things are easy to let go of. Right? Some things are very hard to let go of. Right? In our own working on ourselves, we understand, oh, yeah, letting go of certain desires or needs or, wow, yeah, I'm great at that. But don't ask me to give up chocolate. I draw the line, or don't have me give up that, or, you know what I mean? Like, I draw the line. People say things like that. So we know the that everything's unfolding because of causes and conditions. That's a very fundamental basis of Buddhist view. It's not a random universe. It's not a universe that is, you know, we're not the plaything of the gods. Right? Everything is unfolding because of causes and conditions. It's a very kind of realistic, practical kind of way of looking at life. And so this person who happens to be your child has their own causes and conditions. And the problem is we've never understood that, you see. We thought they were the product of us, right? And we could mold them in the way we wanted to. We could protect them. We could keep them going in the way we always wanted them to grow. Is that true? Yeah. And that's a typical parental intention. It's all good. And then we run up into the reality that they have their own causes and conditions. They have their own karma. And again, it's that same thing we were talking about earlier. You know, can I accept that this is the reality? This is the reality of this person right now. Is there anything I can do to help them? Do they even want my help or not? And as we say, if there's something that can be done to help them, do it. But if there's nothing that can be done, then accept that with understanding and love. I don't think there's anybody who's listening to this talk who is not there or has not been there with somebody. Is that true? Yeah, I mean, that's... And so when we, like, just for people online, everybody's nodding their heads. I mean, this is to have an open view means to accept everything. You know, there are some things like right here, oh, I can accept this, you see. But to kind of, you know, then when we kind of practice is like opening it, right? And we're going to run into, you know, parts of us that don't want to open that much. And that's how we develop the strength. I mean, that's how we develop to know that our insight is really clear. Right? I mean, it's like what always happens, you know, we talk about impermanence, sickness, old age, and death, and how that's natural and comes to everyone, right? And then it happens. It happens to me, happens to a loved one, and we go, what? No. There you go. No. Right? I can accept it. Theoretically, I mean, I can accept the Buddha's teachings as very coherent theory, but here it is in reality, happening to myself, happening to a loved one, and you just feel, we say no, this is not supposed to happen. But the truth is what? It's happening. And that's a moment, that's a challenge where we're invited, you see, life is inviting us to develop wisdom. A wisdom that goes beyond intelligence. Intelligence means it's like an intellectual understanding, right? Like there's nobody who doesn't intellectually understand that everybody dies. Right? There's nobody who doesn't intellectually understand that everybody gets sick. There's nobody who intellectually doesn't understand that we get old, we deteriorate. I mean, we all understand that. Right, intellectually, but wisdom is where we really know it. Right, and that's a difference between intelligence and wisdom. And again, for many of us, we have to take that next step. Thank you, everyone.